From the heartland of America, on the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Stephen Bassett joins us in the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. Here's what's happening. A tragedy, of course, over the weekend in New York. Two police officers savagely shot to death, and then the gunman committed suicide. While the estranged family of the cop killer said that his life was spiraling out of control and that they tried to get him help before he fatally shot those two police officers, the disturbed 28-year-old man posted his hatred for police on Instagram and tried to commit suicide about a year ago. Very sad story there, but it's a bigger story because there is hatred everywhere toward police. And let me tell you something, folks. They put their lives on the line every day for you, every day. And yes, we've had some episodes where you can question some of the tactics, but by and large, 98% of the police officers are great people. Peter Bregan, of course, our staff psychiatrist with us. Peter, I wish I could talk to you under better circumstances tonight, but maybe we will during as we get closer to Christmas in the next day or two. But I want your opinion as a psychiatrist. Why are these people doing these vendettas, these revenge-type killings?
Well, I think in the case of Brinsley, you have a really disturbed guy catching on to a certain element in our culture right now, which is saying, get the police. And that's been, and I'm just with you 100% on what you were saying earlier about, you know, respecting the police. The police have an incredibly difficult job. It's kind of almost beyond my imagination how difficult it's got to be to carry a weapon, to be very restricted in your use of the weapon, to have to stand for insults, and to deal with people who are out of control all the time. And
well, and the problem, Peter, they're wearing a uniform. They're wearing a uniform. They're moving targets.
Well, absolutely. And there is a backlash going on now. I'm glad to see the mayor of New York coming out and saying, let's take a moratorium at least.
He better.
The funerals are over. That seems to say a lot more than that. It is very easy for somebody who, like Brinsley, who shot the two policemen in their cars, to look for something that's in the culture, in the society, in the politics, to show that he can go a step further. And I think that the way the news is covered, what were essentially have been riots, and the way they've covered it in a way that basically is loaded toward the idea of the of victims standing up to the police, I think is very one-sided. And you know, I know there's racism in America. I have no doubt about
that. Of course,
there's racism in every culture, every place in the world. But I don't think we should be fanning rage at the police. I think we, and I hope we're going to see a real different direction.
I hope so. We're going to have to. Peter, thanks so much. We'll be in touch. North Korea's internet was experiencing a major disruption. Could be the target of an attack, according to a company that monitors internet performance. After 24 hours of increasing instability, North Korean national internet had been down for 9 hours. It's back up now. The reported outage comes amid an escalating war of words between the United States and North Korea over that massive cyber attack on Sony Pictures. And North Korea says that President Barack Obama is recklessly spreading rumors of a North Korean orchestrated cyber attack on Sony. And North Korea warning of striking the White House, the Pentagon, and the whole U.S. mainland, that they call us a cesspool of terrorism. In China, of course, says it's opposed to all forms of cyber attacks, but that there is no proof that North Korea was responsible for the hacking of Sony Pictures. But let's check in with the expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, the FBI says it came from North Korea. So who do we believe?
Yeah, I obviously can't make a definitive statement on this. I still am where I was when we talked about this last time. I'm in the we really don't know camp, and we're probably never really going to know camp. The problem is there's so many different, not just technical issues here, but political issues that kind of just put a smoke screen over everything. As far as the current situation is concerned with the breakdown in North Korea, this is kind of interesting. All of North Korea's internet connections do come through China, it turns out. That's their entree into the internet. And it sounds pretty dramatic when you hear that their internet was down for 9 hours, but you've got to realize that if we took your home internet systems and my home internet systems and combined them together, we might well exceed Korea's entire internet capability.
Yeah.
Not really, but you've got to understand, their internet is teeny weeny, teensy tiny. Very, very few people are allowed access to it, really only top government officials, probably mostly to look at porn, I would suspect. And what's happened is that the kind of attack that apparently took them down today was a pretty standard distributed denial of service attack. And those can be basically called up commercially. I mean, there are actually sites on the internet where you pay a few dollars and they will do a DDoS attack for you. So anybody who got it into their head saying, hey, let's take down Korea's internet today, could have done it.
Yeah.
The bottom, you know, it's really gotten, you know, out of control in all kinds of different ways. Late today we heard that Sony was threatening Twitter. I don't know if you heard this yet. Sony was threatening Twitter, saying that if Twitter didn't delete the tweets and close the accounts of people who were linking to information that came from the hack attack, they would sue Twitter. And this has all kinds of interesting, because now you're starting to talk about freedom of speech issues,
right,
when information has already been released.
Well, and we had a story today, too, that the Russian authorities are kept convinced Facebook to shut down a page. There was a opposition leader in a big group of people trying to rally, and they were going to get together on Facebook. Facebook took that down.
Yeah, that's a very controversial story today, in fact. And Facebook has been very reluctant to say anything on the record about why this happened. And you know, a dispassionate observer looking at this might say, well, let's face it, Facebook is trying to drastically expand their operations in Russia, and to do that now under Putin, that means you have to toe the line on all kinds of things, including giving the Russian government direct access to basically all of your systems. So it's the kind of situation, you know, if you sleep with dogs, you're going to get Russian fleas. Right?
I send some more controls. Lauren, thanks. Have a great holiday. U.S. home resales tumble to a 6-month low in November after two straight months of strong increases, underscoring the uneven nature of the housing market recovery. The flu season picking up steam just in time to ruin a lot of people's holidays. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports widespread flu activity in 29 states, primarily in the South and Midwest. That's twice as many states as the previous week. So far this season, sadly, the virus has killed 11 children. Gary Ridenour, the expert on infectious diseases, with us. Gary, what's your take on the flu season this year?
Well, it's going to be, already the CDC has said it's going to be a potentially nasty flu season. That sounds like a weather forecast, but you have to understand, they muffed the vaccine, and the virus that's running around, influenza A, 70% of it is resistant to the vaccine.
That's a lot.
That's an awful lot. And then it's the big gun. H3N2 influenza A is everywhere. And the reason they missed it is that the virus mutated, and so it really doesn't do anything. 70% of the viruses out there are absolutely resistant.
Well, bottom line, too, Gary, build up your immune system. That's the important thing. Thanks so much. Joe Cocker, the singer and songwriter whose hits include this song, You Are So Beautiful, and Up Where We Belong, has died of lung cancer. He was 70 years old, one of the most prolific artists in the era. Cocker released 40 albums over his 50-year career. What a great talent he was. And another great talent, radio icon Casey Kasem, has finally been buried 6 months after his death, laid to rest in Norway. His wife, Jean, did so without consulting the children. That has been a mess. Casey Kasem, one of the great radio superstars of all time. In a moment, Anthony Peake joins us. We're going to talk about the immortal mind, the infinite minefield, and much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Anthony Peake grew up near Liverpool, England, home of the Beatles. He is a member of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, the Scientific and Medical Network, and the Society for Psychic Research. As I mentioned, a couple of his works, The Immortal Mind, The Infinite Minefield, and of course he has so much more. He is here for a couple hours on Coast to Coast. His one of his first books, by the way, is There Life After Death. Anthony, quite an extraordinary career here in the paranormal world. So welcome to the program.
Great to be on. Absolutely delighted to be with you.
Tell me a little bit more about yourself. I have never talked with you before, so I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. Well, I was born way back in 1954, as you say, near Liverpool. So I was fortunate enough to be of an age when the Beatles were starting up and everything else, which was an amazing period, as you can imagine. We felt we were the center of the universe. But went away to university in 1973, to the University of Warwick, and then I studied sociology and history, and then I did postgrad at the London School of Economics and Business Management. But all through my early years, I was fascinated by consciousness and the interface between consciousness and external reality. The reason being, I had double pneumonia in 1966, and during that time I had a period of very, very powerful hallucinations. Now, as you probably know, there is the crisis of pneumonia, whereby, you know, it's a really kind of dangerous period of time where either you possibly could die or you might survive. Fortunately, as is self-evident, I survived, but what it did do for me was to actually focus a comparatively young 12-year-old mind, the idea of exactly what is reality, what are dreams, because these images that I had in my mind were incredibly powerful, three-dimensional and very, very real. And I started reading a part work called Man, Myth, and Magic, which was about exactly that. It was about the fringe areas of human psychology and also belief systems, which developed in me an interest also in comparative religions. What I would say is the more scientific, more sociological side of belief, which I continued at university. But over the years, I continued reading books after books after books on the subject. And it was only probably, again, when I was probably in my mid-30s, I had a very, very powerful deja vu sensation, which stunned me. And I realized this was related to my suffering classical migraine. And I started to think, well, there's links here with neurology. Is it just to do with you know, sort of weird and wonderful subjects, or is there something deeper here? Can we come across a scientific explanation for these extraordinary experiences? And I was fortunate enough in 1999 into 2000 to have a period of time where I was free. I'd been involved in a business contract, including some work over in Poland, and I had sufficient cash to take a year out to write a book. And indeed, that is where my first book, Is There Life After Death? Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die, actually came to pass. But the book itself, I almost felt like it wrote itself, in the sense that as I was writing it, ideas just seemed to spontaneously occur in my mind. I found that the books I needed to read, the people I needed to speak to, all seemed to be given to me almost. It was a very, very curious period of my life. And in the end, what started out as basically a book about near-death experiences and consciousness ended up with something I call Cheating the Ferryman, which was what to me at the time was a very, very inclusive explanation of what happens to human consciousness at the point of death.
What were you able to conclude about that?
Well, Cheating the Ferryman, initially I was very fortunate in the sense that I had a great deal of help from Professor Bruce Grayson and also Phyllis Atwater, two individuals that...
two giants. Both...
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Giants in the industry.
Oh, totally. I mean, Bruce was profoundly helpful, and I went through the process of actually joining the International Association of Near-Death Studies on Bruce's suggestion. And in fact, my first published paper was an academic paper published in their journal, which was outlining the Cheating the Ferryman hypothesis, which Bruce was so amazed at, he actually turned around and said it was the most revolutionary idea regarding near-death experience he'd ever encountered. And what I concluded was that at the point of death, something very curious happens in the brain. Now, you will probably have interviewed many people who've had near-death experiences.
Yes.
And there are two or three things that in what are called the Moody traits. These are the things that Raymond Moody actually isolated as being the typical things that somebody has in a near-death experience. And two of them particularly struck me. One of them was what's called a panoramic life review, when they turn around and say, you know, my life flashed before my eyes. I saw every incident in my life. And I was particularly intrigued by this because it tends to happen with people whose death is unexpected. You know, mountain climbers, somebody falls off a cliff, somebody's involved in a car crash, where they seem to know they're about to die or death could be inevitable. This tends to happen then. But also another thing which was rather curious, where people claim that time starts to slow down, that there is a sensation that they fall into this timeless state. Now, I pulled those two things together, and I thought, wait, hold on a minute, we might have something here that's intriguing, because we might also be able to explain déjà vu. Because I thought to myself, well, there's the argument of reincarnation and the idea that when you die, you come back as somebody else. And I thought to myself, what if you don't come back as somebody else? What if you come back as yourself? In other words, reincarnation happens, literally reincarnation, but it's reincarnation into your own life. And that at the moment of death, you're catapulted back to the moment of your birth. And you relive your life in a groundhog life scenario, whereby you live your life again, and you experience your life again in some form of holographic recreation of your life.
Do you make, Anthony, the same mistakes that you might have made in that previous life? Or do you correct them?
That is the very important point. People who have read my books, I mean, the first book now has sold around about 40,000 copies worldwide, so people are contacting me continually on this. And one of the mistakes people make, and it's probably my inabilities as a writer rather than their abilities to think through the ideas, is that I take a great deal of time discussing quantum physics, particularly the reasons for believing the Everett Many Worlds hypothesis, you know, something that was cited by Hugh Everett III back in 1957, whereby to explain certain unusual observed phenomena of the quantum world, one explanation is that the universe splits into identical copies of itself millions of times a second, effectively at every quantum act, the universe splits itself. Now, if this is the case, it means, and this is something we can talk about later in my later work, this means that effectively somewhere, every outcome for every decision made by everything, every sentient being, and maybe every non-sentient being or anything, is encoded in a huge field of information or information. And this field can be accessed, which means it's effectively similar to a three-dimensional third-person computer game. You know, effectively, I'm of an age where I remember Lara Croft and Tomb Raider. Now, if you remember when you're playing Tomb Raider, the game you play, everything and every outcome of every decision that the on-screen sprite, your Lara Croft on the screen, makes is encoded on the DVD or the CD-ROM.
Right.
But while you're playing the game, you live the game linearly. Every decision that you make, Lara then does on the screen. She runs down a corridor and she encounters a monster. The monster comes out and kills her. You go back to the start of the game, but this time you, the game player, know that there's going to be a monster around the corner. So next, when you play the game, as far as Lara on the screen is concerned, she still doesn't know there's a monster around the corner. And imagine for a minute she was sentient. She feels herself motivated to run down the corridor, and suddenly something motivates her to not go down that corridor and go down another one. Okay? So it means she avoids the monster. Now, I think this is what possibly may happen in this second, the bit of life that you live again in the final millisecond of your life. In other words, you live the whole life. But this time, there is a part of you that has the memories of your last life. And I call this part of you the daemon, which I discuss in greater detail in my second book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self. This is the guardian angel. This is the spirit we, many of us, experience, you know, where you suddenly feel something's wrong. I have, since the writing of my first book, I've had scores of people from around the world who have written to me, who have had absolute amazing experiences whereby their lives have been saved by a voice in the head, sometimes by something physically turning the wheel of a car to avoid an accident, sometimes just an inkling to not go somewhere.
Hold on, Anthony. I want to talk about that voice in the head. That is so important. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back as we get our Christmas week underway. Anthony Peake with us. You can find his website and his Facebook page linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Anthony, you were saying something that I found very provocative, and that is that little voice that we hear that somehow seems to save us or pull us out of a mess. Is that little voice the previous us, or is it that guardian angel? Who is it? What is it?
It's a little bit of both. It's the previous us in the sense it's the part of you that remembers your last life. It's also your game player. I know this sounds very odd, but we may touch on later the strong evidence to presume that we are living within a form of computer simulation. But effectively, this is the game player. This is the person that knows your life. It is your guardian angel. It is it's something that's been known throughout history and something that has been known across all cultures. In my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, I did a great deal of research on this, and I was fascinated that you even found it in Hawaii, before Hawaii was discovered by the West, for instance. Now, Hawaii is a very isolated set of islands, and yet even they had a very similar idea that there is an immortal part of you that actually can influence the part of you that is living now. Now, the interesting thing about this, of course, if you think about it, if you live your life again, or you're living your life again, and you live it multiple times, each time like a computer game, there's always going to be a point where you and your higher self, the being I call the daemon, both do not know what's going to happen next, because you didn't. This is as far as you got last time. And I argue this is why, and this is a very important point, this is why deja vu sensations, as you get older, become less. Because the statistics have shown consistently that the older we get, the less deja vu sensations we have. By deja vu, I mean that recognition that you've lived this moment before, or sometimes a sensation of precognition that you know what's going to happen next. Now, effectively, as you go through the game, there will be more, that you'll be in a new part of the game that neither you nor your daemon has experienced. By the way, the you that's in the game, I call the eidolon. Both the daemon and the eidolon are actually terms that were used by the ancient Greeks and used by the Gnostics. And they're terms that I think really get across the idea of this higher self. Because if you read into history, the amount of people who claimed they had a daemon, Socrates was the first person to really cite the idea that he had a higher self that guided him. People like Rudyard Kipling. Kipling considered that all his books and many of his short stories had been written effectively for him or narrated for him by this voice in his head. This is the daemon, this is the guiding spirit, but this is you, but it's the universal you, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it sure does. And how do we guarantee that that universal you is going to come through time and time again for us?
That is the interesting thing. It seems to come through in many, many different ways. It depends upon the channels of communication between the universal you, the daemon, and the eidolon. Now, I've done quite a lot of work on this, and I'm really fascinated by certain neurochemicals within the brain and the way certain neurochemicals function within the brain. And I'm intrigued to notice that individuals who have certain unusual or less normal neurological structures tend to hear the voice of the daemon more often or can be contacted by the daemon. And for instance, I cite people who have temporal lobe epilepsy, people who have autism, and in extremes, people who have schizophrenia when it's going too far. In other words, there was a term that was used by William Blake that was then adapted by Aldous Huxley called the doors of perception. And I argue that depending upon certain neurological constructs in the brain, the doors of perception are either very slightly ajar or they're widely ajar. And this depends upon how your brain functions. There is even an argument to say it could be left and right hemisphere to do with the brain, because there have been examples of split brain operations by people like Roger Sperry and Michael Gazzaniga in the 1960s and 70s, where individuals whose corpus callosum had been cut, that is the thick nerve body that holds the two sides of the brains together. For certain individuals with intractable epilepsy, there was an operation that took place where this was cut, And Sperry and Gazzaniga actually discovered that when they did this, they ended up effectively with a person with two personalities. So the channels are available. And one of the things I'm hoping for a future book, and this is hot off the presses, by the way, I'm in negotiations with a group of quite interesting individuals in the UK where we are going to be coming together. In fact, we'll be having a meeting in the House of Lords over here in the UK in January to discuss how we can take this idea forward and to train and facilitate the communication channels. So it's something we're working on at the moment to see if there are ways we can facilitate this.
That is amazing work that you've been doing, Anthony. And I think it's probably cutting edge, though a lot of people, as you have said, who are in this field have felt this. It seems like you're almost making a scientific push for this.
Oh, totally. I mean, one of my major points all the time, and if anybody reads any of my books, you will discover this, that everything I say in my books, every single concept, every single reference, is cross-referenced back to academic papers. In other words, I take very much the idea that extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs, and this is exactly what I do. You will have the academic paper, and you can read the academic paper yourself, go back to source material, and come to your own conclusion as to whether my conclusions are valid. In other words, there is nothing I say that isn't from either well-recorded experiences, is from known scientific processes or procedures, or hypothetical scientific processes and procedures. What I'm doing is I'm pulling together areas of learning from disparate subjects such as neurochemistry through to quantum physics, through to psychology, psychiatry, and mystical experiences, and theology, and various other subjects. So I'm very holistic in my approach. But my ideas, I'm not somebody who has a kind of a belief system and I'm pushing it on people. What I am is somebody who's saying, hey guys, look at this, isn't this fascinating? What do we make of this? What do we collectively, because this is far too important to just belong to me. You know, I say this time and time again in my interviews. This is not Anthony Peake's idea anymore. It's out there. Other people are pursuing some of the ideas I've had. People contact me and say, do you know, are you aware of this particular piece of work? Are you aware of this piece of research? Are you aware of the holographic arguments in terms of the universe? These are all things that I pursue. And this is why my ideas are iterative and adaptive. They change, because of course they do, because pure science is this. It's a search for the truth. It's not something to say I have a belief and I'm trying to prove my belief. This is far from it.
Well, that's true. And with deja vu, I used to have more deja vu experiences than I'm having now. As a matter of fact, I can't remember having one in a long time. What does that mean, the fact that I'm not getting them anymore?
Yeah, that's what I touched upon earlier. There have been research papers done on this. I mean, there's a fair amount of research on deja vu that's been made over the years, including some hypothetical theories, such as the visual pathways theory of Robert Efron, which are still cited in psychological books and textbooks, which in fact are no longer valid, but that's an aside point. To me, this is powerful evidence, if ever there was evidence needed, that we are living within a computer simulation and that we're living within an equivalent computer game of our own lives. As I touched on before, the older we get, the more chances are that our daemon would have made a decision for us or influenced in some way to take a different path than we did last time. So in other words, you're Lara Croft again when she's playing Tomb Raider. When she's halfway through the game, she has avoided a lot of dangers and survived. But there will be a point where she will encounter something that the game player has not encountered before. Now, if that is the case, she will not have any memories of this encounter. So she will not get the deja vu remembering. Because remember, deja vu, or technically deja vecu, which is more precise, which is already lived, where it was deja vu, which is already seen, is that she will not have lived it before. So therefore, she will not know how to react. She will have no memories of it. The daemon will not know what to do. And she'll probably end up being killed. We'll go back to the start of the game and start again. So this is why. But it's intriguing that when we get towards the end of our life, whatever our life will be, these things start to kick in again. It's as if these memories start to flood back and the warnings about the dangers start to happen. Because time and time again, people have these sensations of knowing they're about to die. An example of this is one of my latest books is a biography of the American science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. And in this, I cite an example towards the end of the book of a most uncanny experience where Philip K. Dick actually knew the circumstances of his own death. He actually saw it in a dream. He had a dream of a man lying flat on his stomach between a coffee table and a settee, a middle-aged man. And
Abraham Lincoln had one of those, too.
He did. He saw himself, didn't he? He saw himself in his own coffin in the White House. Now, again, these are all kind of warnings from the daemon. But sometimes even the daemon, for instance, the daemon cannot do anything if you've got a terminal illness, because unless it can make you avoid eating the food that may have caused it. Could Abraham Lincoln's daemon have avoided Lincoln being shot by John Wilkes Booth in the theater? Possibly he could have done by engineering it so that Lincoln wasn't at the theater. But this is an important point and a very important one. Remember, we are all like this. Or arguably 70% of us are like this, and I'll touch upon this later why this is. This is in our worldview, George Norrie and Anthony Peake's worldview, where these incidents took place.
Right.
In another worldview, in another alternate universe, Lincoln could have survived the assassination and gone on and been president until the 1880s. Our worldview that happened.
Is that what possibly the multiverse theory might be, where there are many universes and maybe on each one is a separate Anthony Peake, a separate George Norrie, each experiencing some kind of related but different life?
You've got it, George. That's exactly it. There is the hyper you, the hyper Q you, the tesseract you that came across very, very slightly in a recent movie called Interstellar, where at the end sequence you saw one of the characters viewing the past from the fifth dimension, from outside of space-time. Now, if you looked at this way, it means that effectively encoded within the zero-point field, within the Akashic field that Irvin Laszlo calls it, which we'll touch upon later, there is encoded there the outcome of every event in your life. It's already in there. And there will be a George Norrie or an Anthony Peake that will encounter at some stage or other all those alternatives. And in fact, if we argue that outside of the fourth dimension of time, if you're in a timeless state, everything is concurrent. So therefore, all those multiple lives all exist concurrently, as do all the lives of all other people and all of the people that have ever lived. So this explains mediumship, explains hypnotic regression, it explains past lives, it explains so much if we look at it this way. So you're the George Norrie that has pursued this career, is involved in Coast to Coast and everything else, but there might be another George Norrie who is a rocket scientist or a truck driver in Akron. You know, there are so many different versions of what we can do. You are the one that's followed this route, but this is not the real you. The real you is the daemon. The real you is the being that is outside of time, that is looking down. And, of course, there is an argument in my book, The Infinite Mindfield, I expand on this, to say, in fact, we're all one single consciousness experiencing itself subjectively.
All sharing. I call it the wireless internet, Anthony.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Because the more we advance and the more we understand about computing and cloud computing and how things like that work, the more we start to realize this is how it works. You know, effectively, my consciousness is in my body. It's embodied in my body for 75 years. But when I die, it goes into the cloud to be rebodied again, either as me or one arguably could be reincarnated into somebody else. But I don't tend to pursue that. I do discuss it in my book with Irvin Laszlo, but I don't tend to pursue that because I much like the idea of you having the opportunity. It's like Groundhog Day, isn't it, the movie?
Over and over again, yeah.
Yeah, Connors lives that day over and over again. And what does he do? He starts off being selfish, nasty, and not a very nice person. By the end of the... And Danny Rubin, who wrote the screenplay, is somebody I've interviewed in my radio programs. And Danny explained to me that he had planned for Connors to live that day thousands of times. And in the end, he gets it right, doesn't he? He lives the perfect life. He's running around the town. He's under the tree to catch the little boy.
Yeah.
He tries to help the old man who dies. He's there to help the old lady across the road. It's because suddenly all his lives have made him a better person. It's almost like karma. It's the idea that by living your life over and over again, you live the perfect life. So it has a profoundly religious or philosophical tone to this as well. And it is also the wonderful opportunity, isn't it, George, to know that maybe next time round, those decisions you made in your life, and we all have them, where we thought, my gosh, I wish I hadn't done that, your daemon will try and warn you and say, this time round, don't get involved with this person or don't go to this event.
Right.
And you've got a whole new life you can live.
If we could only do that in real life, in this life.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that we can. That's the central point of cheating the ferryman, really.
Anthony, where does, I hate to bring this up as we get close to Christmas, but where does evil fit in with all of this? Because somewhere along the line, there's still evil, there are still demons. How do they fit in?
Well, funnily enough, it's one of the things that I discuss. I have this group of people that are now on Facebook and everything else, which we call the Walker Group, the It Lad Walker Group. It Lad, by the way, is just the initials of my first book, Is There Life After Death? And people who are interested in my work call themselves It Ladians, which is weird. It's a semi-joke. We're not a cult or anything like that. It's just Scouse humor, Liverpool humor is what we do. But the idea is that there could be, in terms of evil, evil as a concept, as you probably know in theological terms, is called theophany. It's theodicy. It's the idea of why does evil exist? And funnily enough, yesterday I was discussing with an associate who is a Sikh about this very issue. And of course, we both agreed in order to see white, you have to have black. So you have to have a counterpoint. And you have to have something that forces you to make choices. Now, the daemon itself, the higher self, your higher self, my higher self, or Hitler's higher self, or Pol Pot's higher self, all made decisions in their lives. The daemon is not particularly moral. The daemon depends upon the personality of the individual. So we have this term we call the cacodemon, the evil daemon, the one that actually pushes somebody to do evil things. But one could argue that even a Hitler or a Pol Pot, after many iterations, Hitler might have decided, you know, that it wasn't good to follow that route. So they won't follow that route in an alternate universe.
Do you think those kinds of entities, spirits, call them whatever you want, that they really do get better?
Well, it's difficult to say, isn't it? One of the things, again, in my book, The Infinite Minefield, I discuss dimethyltryptamine. And I discuss, and I know Rick Strassman has been on your show in the past.
Yes, sure has.
Thank you, Rick, for saying, because Rick sent me a message to wish me luck on the show today. So thanks to him for that. That when people go into alternate states of reality, because I'm arguing these alternate states still exist, and you can move into them, and dimethyltryptamine facilitates this moving into higher states of consciousness. And here, people regularly encounter entities that are what we would consider evil or not, but just no emotions or anything else. These beings clearly seem to exist in the macroverse, and these entities can be negative, you know. And there's, we use a term, my group, we use this term, the Archons, and it's again going back to Gnosticism and going back to the idea that there are elemental beings within the universe who are here to negate things, to actually stop things happening. And people have joked that, you know, I'm getting so close to the truth these days that I need to watch myself, because there are certain entities, organizations, whatever, not going to like what you're doing. I've never come across that, but we do have a running joke that we have Archon attacks. On Facebook recently, my friend Cam McNaughton from Canada had already pointed out that my website was down just before we went online today. And he said, it's typical. The Archons are attacking to make sure that people can't get on your website.
It's the massive amounts of people who crashed your server, Anthony. That's probably...
Yeah, would be nice to know. That would be good, wouldn't it, George?
Okay, stay with us. We've got a final hour to go. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more. I want to talk with you about the zero-point field, and you've written up a lot about that with The Immortal Mind with, as you said, Professor Irvin Laszlo. And we're going to take phone calls as well. Final hour to go. Anthony Peake with us. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.